Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, across the country and the world. It's that time again. It's the Breaking It Down podcast, hosted by yours truly, Mark Mancini, live in Los Angeles, 347-205-9631. If you happen to miss it, I realize 30 minutes goes by quick. blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So as I lay the red carpet down, I put the podium in its place, and I hand off the mic. It's her birthday today, a big birthday for her, Kimberly Resnick Anderson, 30 years as a sex therapist. Second time I'm interviewing her, and this is a good one. We'll be getting into fantasies, swingers, toys, everything like that. And, you know, we keep it professional to the point where, you know, this is one of those shows where you can learn a lot. So, Kimberly, the first thing I want to say to you is, man, I want you to enjoy the day after. It's your big day. How are you?
I am great. Thanks, Mark. I'm so happy to talk with you again.
Oh, I'm blessed. And how can people get a hold of you if they want? Because I'm thinking they will, because this is going to be a nice segment.
Well, I appreciate that. They can always reach me. The best way is through my website, which is just my name, KimberlyResnickAnderson.com. You can also email me directly at Kimberly@KimberlyResnickAnderson.com. I do provide free 15-minute phone consultations, and I'm always happy to address any questions or concerns that any of your listeners may have. Even if they don't become a client, I see myself as a resource for all.
Well, I know that, and so blessed to be doing a podcast here in the next month or so. You and I will be doing a weekly one, so that'll be good. Schedule's permitting, so just letting the listeners know. So, and I know you're going across the realm here, doing a show with Pittsburgh, Dr. Greg Roscoe's, the crazy show out of Phoenix, Arizona, with John Guy and the great people over there. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to a lot of good things. As we talked the first time, 30 years in the business, we talked about how instrumental it was to help people and everything. The question I always said is, people always wanted to know about this, but they were always afraid to ask. And we addressed that, sexless marriages. Who is more prone to not want to have sex as they get older compared to the other side? Today we're going to get into fantasies. And this might be a subject where people go, oh, no, I'm not into this. But, okay, you know, through the realm of things, you know, there's secrets behind closed doors.
Absolutely.
I'll let you open it up to the point where, you know, what you have witnessed and you know, heard, and another thing where people are afraid to bring it to the forefront.
Yeah, for sure. So I talk a lot with people about their what I call arousal template or sexual script, basically just the range of things that people are sexually responsive to or interested in. And I've noticed a couple of trends and patterns over the decades, so I'm happy to share those with you. First, number one, I think fantasy in general is underrated. I think people get threatened by the notion of having a sexual fantasy, or if a partner becomes aware that their partner has a sexual fantasy, it can feel threatening or scary. But I think fantasy is an underutilized component of sexual expression. I think, though, there's a fine line. So I think fantasy can enhance solo pleasuring. I think fantasy can enhance sexual relationships with partners. When I worry is when someone is actually dependent on a particular sexual fantasy or sexual fantasies, and that it becomes a requirement for them to either be engaging in that particular behavior or at least thinking about it, in that they can't be present with their partner in the moment. They have to kind of go somewhere else in their mind to tap into that fantasy in order to complete the phases of sexual response.
So when we look at fantasies, when we start breaking it down, we'll break down a few topics here. And the ones where the dressing up, the ones where the French maid type of thing, the wife dresses up, or, you know, they kind of get into this kind of thing. Is that more of a common thing where you see or hear more of where the spouse, vice versa, is kind of performing in a dress up routine more so than the other things that we'll talk about?
The second trend or sort of consistent pattern that I've become aware of is that most couples don't share their erotic fantasies.
Right.
If you're listening and you think, oh, that's crazy, my husband, my wife, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, they could tell you what I'm into, then you're very lucky and should be grateful for that. Most of the couples I treat have actually never discussed their private erotic fantasies.
Right.
And also have rarely spoken about their sexual expectations, preferences, what they like, what they don't like, what turns them on, what turns them off. And now, these are couples who've been together sometimes 5 years, 10, 20, 30, 40, and they have sex, but they've never had a conversation about what sex means to them, what motivates them to be sexual, what they're sexually responsive to. What I do is just facilitate dialogue between couples. And if I'm seeing someone individually, I'll have a conversation with them to assess how aware are they of the range of things that turn them on. And I have a list of questions that I ask to guide the conversation. And another thing I've noticed, number three, is that when I ask women to describe their sexual fantasies, they often say, well, I don't have fantasies. I think that I don't know what you're talking about. I can't really, you know, come up with anything. But when I ask them questions, almost always there's something there. And they may not realize that that's a fantasy. They may not realize that that's something that is erotic to them. They don't think about it as a fantasy per se, but there are preferences that become quickly illuminated with a little bit of questioning.
Right. So more or less, when you look at fantasies, it's more so the male side of things, more so that would more be more engaging of a conversation, more so than the woman. From what I'm gathering, as far as, you know,
well,
talking about these fantasies.
I wouldn't say that, Mark. What I would say is men have better access to their fantasies than women do, and that men are more comfortable expressing their fantasies than women are. Not that they're more likely to, you know, act them out. They're just more aware of all things sexual because they have 10 times more testosterone. And so they have that hormonal push. Men are also much more visual than women when it comes to erotic response. And so a man can be stimulated by seeing something in a way that a woman might not necessarily be. So, for example, dick pics. Man would love if a woman sent a picture, a nude picture, because it would be so visually and aesthetically pleasing and arousing. But what men don't realize is that the actual organ, the penis itself, is not particularly attractive to most women. And that if when a woman receives a dick pic, it may be titillating in that they're exchanging erotic material, but it's not titillating in the way like, oh my God, you know, a penis. Now I want to have sex with this person. And I don't want to speak over generalistically. I mean, there are some women who, you know, might find that to be actually genuinely erotic, but for most women, it's the notion of discussing and sharing intimate material that is erotic. But for men, it's literally the visual stimulation that can facilitate physiologic arousal on the spot. So if a woman looks at a dick pic, I don't think she's getting wet in the way that a man might look at a picture of a woman and actually get an erection.
Right. And when you look at these, you bring up marriages, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, till death do us part, in most cases. Mm-hmm. But then you kind of look at this whole situation, okay, how do they keep the relationship growing? And from what I've seen out there is a lot of these couples that have been out there for quite a while, and I don't want to generalize a whole bunch of them, just a select few maybe, now try to spruce up the marriage with bringing a third person into this to keep it going. Now, more or less, this thing could be more on the man's side than the woman's side. Am I right on that? And how? What is the percentage of this? Because it seems like it's starting to pick up steam a little.
It certainly is picking up steam, especially in our neck of the woods here on the West Coast. But there are swingers all over the country, all over the world. I want to just explain the difference between some of these terms because I think they're used interchangeably in sloppy ways. So one of the things that I help couples do is open their marriage, engage in what's called ethical non-monogamy, ENM, or sometimes referred to as consensual non-monogamy, CNM. And this is when a couple together chooses to allow or encourage their partner to have sexual relations with people outside of the marriage. Sometimes it's just sex and no emotional connection. Sometimes it is sex and an emotional connection, and that would fit more into the umbrella of polyamory, which literally means loving many, so having a love relationship with more than one person. And under those conditions, we talk about a primary and a secondary or a tertiary partner, where your spouse or your primary partner remains in a spot of status, and then your secondary partner is sort of a supplemental partner. And this is very tricky and complicated because humans are naturally envious and jealous, and it can be very uncomfortable for many people to tolerate those feelings when they know that their partner is expressing sexual and loving feelings with another person. It's not for the faint of heart. It often leads to disaster. But I have seen some couples and do work with some couples who do it very well. And I think there are a couple of conditions that need to be in place in order for it to work well. The first is that both partners have to be on board. And normally it's one person kind of driving it, and the other person has to be convinced. And sometimes people agree to that under duress or feel coerced or do it to save their relationship when their heart really isn't in it. Under those conditions, it's certainly not going to go well. But I see more and more couples who meet on open relationship apps or websites, and so they both share that non-monogamous orientation from the beginning. And I think those couples do better because there's no pretense of monogamy, and they both value the option to express themselves sexually with more than one person. So that's one condition that I think helps couples be successful. Another condition is that they explore their expectations and negotiate boundaries in advance rather than just wing it and see what happens. So a lot of my work with couples who are engaging in ethical non-monogamy is to try to anticipate scenarios just based on my clinical experience around what are the traps, what are the things that they may not anticipate happening, but I've seen happen. So I can say to them, hey, you know, this might happen, or you might feel this way, or you might be surprised, or you might like this more than you think, or you may not like this as much as you think. And the couples who do their due diligence, do their homework, take the time to prepare in advance, and then engage in what's called aftercare, which is a very intentional period following an encounter with an extramarital partner or extra relational partner, where there is care given, emotional and or sexual care or affection, to fortify the primary relationship as a foundational relationship.
And you bring up interesting points. And the first point I want to elaborate on is one of the partners is driving it to get this thing going. So
often,
is it more driven?
But not always.
Yeah,
often,
yeah.
But not always. Yeah.
Exactly. Is it more driven by the male to try to spruce up the marriage to get it going, or would it be the opposite side? Is it more?
It's a great question. So I would say historically it has definitely been more male driven, but I would say in the last 3 to 5 years, I've seen more and more women initiating this lifestyle. So I would say it's still not equal, but it's a lot closer to equal than it was 20, 30 years ago when I started practicing.
So when you look at this, where and then you're right, as far as if they're going to go on to this kind of realm of things, you more or less have to talk this out, communicate, because it could be a disaster, you know, to the point where somebody might just think, hey, this is going to be a nice thing, you know, let's try this. And then before you know it, it goes in a whole different direction, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. I've seen relationships crash and burn. As I said, this is not something that I'm recommending or, you know, support in any formal way. What I do is I meet my patients where they are, and if they come to me and this is a goal or a value that they want to explore, I'll help them explore it. And I'm not quite sure how, but I'm sort of one of the go-to people in LA for help with opening up a relationship. Not quite sure what circuit I got on, but now, you know, usually every week I'll get a call from a couple saying, you know, we heard that you help people with this. Would you be willing to help us? We're considering this. Can you walk us through the pros and cons? We're not sure we want to do this. You know, or I'll hear from a couple and they'll say, we did this kind of half-assed. We didn't do our homework and it blew up in our face. Can you help us recover from this? Or can you help us do this in a healthier manner moving forward?
Great points across the board. Three quick things I want to talk about. I know we got about 12 minutes, and there's so much to talk about, and then we'll talk about the toy thing real fast. But when we're looking at the swingers clubs, for people that want to, you know, experience this, or if they've experienced it, the protection in place, you know, what does that all entitle at some of these things? Are people getting tested before they get in these things, or they just going in there? And because what you want to look at is, if you're doing that kind of stuff, you don't want to catch something and then bring it back.
Right.
You know, so that would be probably important.
So interestingly, or maybe not interestingly, depending on the, you know, sort of notions of your listeners, people who engage in what's called the lifestyle, and that's sort of the word that my patients use, are pretty responsible, more responsible often than the average bear, because they know that the risks are higher, and they tend to be more sex positive and more respectful of boundaries. So they often are quite responsible and respectful of safe sex. They often will, get tested. People, it's not uncommon to pull up your negative STI test on your phone under these conditions. Sometimes you have to submit that stuff in advance before you can even participate. You have to show proof, like with a COVID vaccine,
right.
You kind of have to show that you are safe and clean to participate. But there are exceptions to that, and there are places where you could go and there aren't screenings and the risk increases. So it really depends more on how legitimate of a spot you're going to. And, you know, there's parties at people's homes, there's parties at hotels, there's parties in dungeons. There's a lot going on out there. So there's sex parties where people go and they just sort of, it's more orgy-esque, more orgy adjacent,
right.
Where they just sort of have sex with whoever they want, and it's lots of group sex and lots of multiple sexual encounters in an evening. And then there's a different sort of cohort of people who only want to have sex with one or possibly two people outside of their relationship. And then there are people who just want random or anonymous sex with different people, and they don't want to have a repeat sexual encounter. And the way that is negotiated is through, exploration of values and erotic interest. And some couples land on a don't ask, don't tell situation. Others want to know what's going on, and they want to share as much as possible. And it actually is erotic or titillating for them to hear about the sexual exploits that they have with other people. Sometimes men are pretty aroused and they want to know, how did he touch you? How big was his penis? How many times did you have an orgasm? Did you have anal sex? These sorts of things can actually be erotic for some men. Other men find it to be slightly more humiliating and they don't want to know, but they support in theory this notion of what's called compersion. Compersion is a polyamory term, and it means that you love your partner so much that if they're happy, you're happy, and if something gives them pleasure or joy, even if it's not involving you or coming from you, that you support it. It's sort of the antithesis of jealousy.
That it's great. The way that you broke it, it makes a lot of sense. 6 minutes and change. You could take a couple minutes to break this one down. Cuckolds and hot wives. This has been another big thing, and this probably runs hand in hand with somebody bringing somebody into a marriage here to spice it up, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So men who are sexually responsive to the thought of their partners having sex with someone else tend to fall into one of two categories. Like you say, there's either the cuckold group or what I call the kind of hot wife category. And I'm talking in this moment about, straight couples. There are other manifestations of these dynamics in LGBTQ relationships, but I don't think we have time to touch on that today.
Right.
So some men actually are sexually responsive to being humiliated, and the thought of sort of being forced to watch or forced to listen to details or hear stories about other men pleasing their wives in a way that suggests that they're maybe inadequate or not proficient lovers can be very, very stimulating. Some men have to tap into that humiliation in order to maybe get an erection or have an orgasm. Then there's this other camp of men who feel empowered and masculine around the thought of other men being with their wives, because in the end, their wives come home to them, and they feel like they're sort of bestowing their wives' sexuality upon these other guys in a way that, like, I'm going to share with you because I'm the big man, and
right.
You know, I'm going to let you have a little taste of what I get to eat every day.
Right.
And it actually makes them feel stronger and more powerful, and it's the opposite of humiliation. So those tend to be the two categories or camps that I see in that regard.
So the guy that's basically sharing would be considered maybe like a bull.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Hey,
yep.
It's amazing. And in the next go-round, we're going to get into the next interview. Will be couples and counseling. But just to finish this up, exactly 3 minutes and 10 seconds, toys. I know a lot of people, you know, use toys and everything, and they may, you know, I can remember, you know, working in a hotel and opening up a trunk and all the toys fell out of this lady's suitcase, and I'm saying to myself, okay, so toys play a big part in all this too, I would imagine.
Toys are another somewhat controversial topic in my therapy office because so many women have difficulty achieving orgasm from coitus, from penetrative intercourse, and so many women are unable to do that in any capacity, regardless of partner. They just can't get off from that type of stimulation. And so they need different kind of stimulation, and toys often will do the trick. And a lot of women become sort of dependent on their vibrators or their toys. And many men feel threatened by that and want to be the thing that facilitates the orgasm. Here's what I say about it. If people are having orgasms, it's a good thing. It's good news. It feels good. It's positive and emotionally protective. I think a secure lover would not feel threatened if his female partner or male partner needed or wanted to use a toy to enhance or achieve orgasm. And toys can be used together in so many playful, creative ways that I think anyone who objects to toys categorically is really missing out.
Yeah, definitely. Well, as we wrap this thing up, Kimberly, let everybody know how they can get a hold of you, and I definitely want to wish you another happy birthday and have a blessed day as well. And I can't wait to talk next week with you.
That's so
and
nice.
Keep this
Thank
thing
you.
Going. Yeah.
Yeah, well, let me throw out my phone number. It's 818-334-5811. 818-334-5811. Leave me a message if you have a question. By the way, I do regularly receive phone calls and emails and texts from people thinking that I'm a sex worker or a sex surrogate, or that I'm available for hire to engage in actual physical contact. That's not the type of provider that I am. I'm a licensed mental health provider, and I'm here to answer and educate and support. But even I'm sure that there might be someone listening who has a question or wants to get some clarification on something, and I'd be happy to help.
Yeah, I appreciate this, and I can't wait to do the podcast with you down the line here. As we wrap this up, guys, thanks for tuning in. The third interview of this thing will be couples and counseling. You've listened to the Breaking It Down podcast. She's Kimberly Resnick Anderson. Yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles. Catch the archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports. We'll talk to you again next week. Have a blessed one. Stay safe. And thanks again for tuning in. Kimberly, enjoy the day.
Thank you, Mark. You too.
You're welcome.